may well be old enough to remember of a time, maybe, when garlic, delicious, essential, wonderful garlic, was considered smelly, unrefined, sort of an othered food in this country. At one point of history, it was described as, quote, the atomic bomb of the vegetable world. So smelly, of course, that even vampires can't stand it. That's the cultural reputation of garlic. That, of course, has shifted. But it's a memory that brings me to durians. If you've read any Western food journalism, you'll know that the durian is smelly, freakishly smelly. It's called in the bomb squad and the crime scene cleaners kind of smelly. What else do you know about the durian? What do you know about rambutans or mangosteens? You may even be able to pronounce them. What if the current framing of these foods culturally is preventing you from having a transcendent, almost garlic-level culinary experience? There was a New York Times article recently. It became the centre of heated online discussion around this topic. It was titled, Eating Thai Fruit Demands Serious Effort but Delivers Sublime Reward. I'm going to test that thesis of effort against sublime reward with Lee Tran Lam, a food writer, host of the Unbearable Lightness of Being Hungry podcast. Lee Tran, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
That piece in the New York Times, how did you react to that as somebody writing in that and, you know, journalisming in that space?
I was quite confused, I think, because I grew up eating a lot of those fruits, which I enjoyed and savoured, and it was so much fun when you could get some rambutans or, you know, jackfruit, and then to have it framed in that article. I mean, the intro actually says, many delicious species in Thailand, the great power nation of fruit, require laborious peeling and careful chewing. Then there's a sticky fingers, an occasional disappointment. It's so strange that, you know, someone would be sent out on this amazing assignment to eat all these incredible and vibrant Asian fruits, and then they choose to, you know, frame it as talking about the deep, dank rot of the durian or the sticky sap that, you know, stains your fingernails. And then probably one of the more problematic parts in the story is when the writer Hannah Beach talks about rambutan and says it means hairy thing in Malay, with its crimson skin studded with green feelers, the egg-sized fruit bears more than a passing resemblance to a coronavirus. And it just is a very...
That's fairly loaded.
Yes, interesting way to describe this hugely delicious fruit. And, you know, some people immediately called it out. Novelist Monique Trung said, a rambutan looks like the coronavirus. Why don't you just go ahead and call it the Kung Flu of fruits? And then a great writer, Asay Enderlin, did a brilliant breakdown of this article and why it is quite problematic. And she said, why casually link Southeast Asian fruit to a pandemic in progress that is dripping in racism and xenophobia? Do Thai people describe their food as looking like a deadly virus? And, you know, at a time where there is racism on the rise against people of Asian appearance because of the coronavirus pandemic, to then describe this much-loved fruit as resembling, you know, the spiky appearance of the coronavirus, you know, it doesn't feel like the greatest thing to be doing.
Does this article, do you feel like an outlier? I mean, you know, I would have thought perhaps every time you do think this, that we've reached a sort of a state of cosmopolitan embrace, especially in something like food culture, that we are entranced by variety, that we love multiplicity in food and tastes. But then you get confronted by something like this, which, you know, the underlying assumption in this article is there's one sort of true kind of food, which is white Western food, and the other stuff is weird that we need to explain and explore. It seems like something from the 1950s.
And it is really interesting the way this article from the New York Times, which I think is an amazing, you know, media outlet that does such great reporting, but the way it frames Asian fruit as, you know, weird and smelly and a lot of trouble. And then when you think about something like an artichoke, which I've read
artichoke came into my mind.
Yes. Yeah, I think of so many recipe books that paint it in a romantic way of, oh, you know, preparing an artichoke is a lot of trouble, but it's so worth it. You know, you're a true foodie if you take the time to prepare an artichoke, which, you know, is spiky and difficult, and, you know, it takes a lot of work to even get a little bit of flesh out of an artichoke. It's interesting that that is seen as romantic, whereas this is seen as strange and weird and smelly. And, you know, it's worth considering how this story was reported like it was fact, but it's really opinion. And if you zoom out and you think about how there's a totally different spin on durian, for instance, which is often portrayed in Western media as, you know, smelly and banned in certain countries because it is so stinky. There was a really great piece by Clarissa Wei in Asian Nikkei, where she talked about how for the 670 million residents of Southeast Asia and beyond, the durian is far from noxious. And she talks about the variety of flavors you can get from a durian, that it can be creamy and custardy, or it can resemble bitter, boozy liquor, and how people go to the trouble of having these very elaborate durian parties where each rare durian is served almost like sushi. You know, it's so prized that it's served in a way that really showcases the complexity of the fruit. And, you know, you think in Thailand a year ago, someone paid $50,000 for one durian at the King of Durian Festival. You know, it's called the King of Fruit in Asia for a reason.
You know, we like to think in this country, for example, that we have this incredibly sort of diverse food culture. But is it still one in which post-colonial culture grants admission to certain foods and excludes others? Is there still sort of a culinary cultural gatekeeper class active?
I think there's been a really interesting debate within the last few years within food media about food culture and the kind of food that we value, the kind of restaurants that win awards, and how for a long time, supposed ethnic restaurants, and I'll put like big quotation marks around ethnic, were only valued because they were cheap. You know, cheap and cheerful. You know, that would only appear in like the cheap eat section of a newspaper or a food guide. And then the restaurants that won awards were like usually very expensive European restaurants. And there was a great article that ran on ABC Online about 2 years ago by Colin Ho and Nicholas Jordan, where they really pulled this apart. And they had a great quote from Dan Hong, who essentially said, the chef from Mr. Wong, who said, you know, why is it people only pay, you know, no more than $10 for some dumplings? And dumplings are so hard to make. If you've ever tried to put 18 pleats in one dumpling, I've done it and I completely messed it up. You know, people will not pay more than $10 for a few dumplings, but they will pay $30 or $40 for cacio e pepe, which is pasta, cheese, pepper. It's pretty easy to make. You can do it in about 10 minutes. So there has been, over the last few years, I think, a lot of questioning about why we put a certain kind of food on a pedestal. And then, you know, how often have you heard someone complain about Asian food being expensive? You know, like people always complain about the prices of Asian food, but you rarely hear someone complain that, oh, this pasta was $40, or, you know, they went to some expensive restaurant and spent $200. But yeah, if some noodles are more than $10, people get upset. So it kind of traps supposed ethnic food in this like box that it's only valued if it's cheap.
Is there a need here? I mean, clearly we have, you know, a good diversity in practitioners, people making the food. That part of food culture is a very diverse place, but in the way in which we talk about it, in the way in which food media deals with it, I'm presuming, like any other media in this country, that's, you know, still a very white place. It's not a very diverse place, and that must have some bearing on the othering of certain foods or the way in which various cuisines are treated.
Yeah, I think there are definitely people who are, if we're going to say white journalists who are doing a good job.
It's
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to say because you're a white writer, you can't write about something with respect or cultural context. But obviously, we are informed by the way we grew up, what we ate. If you grew up and you were told your food was weird or different, you're obviously going to write about it in a different way. If you grew up with, you know, immigrant parents and you got shamed in the playground for having smelly food, you are going to approach the way you write about that food in a different way from someone who might supposedly find it exotic or strange or, you know, doesn't know the cultural context of, you know, the refugee family who runs a local restaurant that specializes in that cuisine. And I think for me, the thing that summarizes how very skewed food media can be is you've probably heard of the world's 50 best restaurant list.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So it categorized supposedly the best restaurants in the world. And on that list, there is only one restaurant from mainland China, and it's run by a French guy. It has 10 seats. The menu starts from $800. And it's crazy to think that supposedly in this country with 1 billion people, there is no other great Chinese restaurant. And someone actually pointed out if the people who are going to this 10-seater restaurant, if supposedly all these world 50 best judges were going to this restaurant to be able to judge it, right? I think one in five nights there would be a world 50 best judge there. I just don't think statistically that's true. There's probably a few people claiming they've been that maybe didn't go. But I think that shows you how so often what is valued as good food in media is expensive food, inaccessible food, and European in style, and it really prioritizes tasting menu food as complex and technically marvelous. Whereas, as we talked about before, like trying to put 18 pleats on a dumpling is actually a real technical marvel, but that doesn't get the award.
Now, this discussion and the themes that we've been talking about here, this is in part why you and a few others have begun a new thing called Diversity in Food Media. Tell us what you've got boiling away there.
Yeah, so we are working behind the scenes on quite a few things. We'd like to eventually make public a database of, you know, diverse food writers and content creators such as photographers, to make that public so that when people are looking for someone to write an article or do a cooking video perhaps, they might consider someone whose name they haven't seen in another media outlet. You know, there are a lot of people who are working behind the scenes, but maybe they don't have a high profile because they're not featured in regional or metropolitan newspaper. And one thing I'm also doing is I started an Instagram account to focus on like the diversity of the people who are covering food in Australia. And it's quite incredible. And I found it very illuminating. So one of the people I featured is Chloe Sargent, she's an award-winning LGBTQI writer, but she also writes a lot about her chronic illness. And she is starting a recipe site for people who do have chronic illness, because so often when you are ill on a regular basis, you don't have the energy to spend a lot of time cooking, but you do need to keep yourself well. And she said so many recipes claim to be simple, but they're not simple. They're really inaccessible. They're really hard to make. And she wants to create a website that has truly simple recipes because that's what people with chronic illness need.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And I found that so, you know, eye-opening because for a lot of people, they just slap simple in a description because it's clickbait. Say this is the most simple recipe for this or that, not realizing that it actually does have implications for people who truly do need simple recipes.
Is that Instagram account the best place to get a toehold in diversity in food media and your work? Is that the place to go to?
Yeah, for now, we're hoping to roll out some other initiatives and we hope to, you know, do workshops and mentoring and so forth. But yes, it's currently instagram.com/diversityinfoodmedia.au. And definitely direct message us if you think there's someone we should be covering. Maybe there's someone who has a YouTube cooking show who, you know, maybe they only have 10 viewers, but what they're doing is really great. Or maybe, you know, someone who's doing like a local podcast on Middle Eastern food. You know, there's so much possibility. And I think there are probably a lot of people out there doing interesting stuff who don't yet have a bigger platform, but definitely should.
A wonderful way to discover new worlds in food and people. Litran, thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, thank you so much for your time. It's been really great to talk to you.
Litran Lam, food writer, host of the Unbearable Lightness of Being Hungry podcast, brains behind this new thing, Diversity in Food Media AU. We'll put that link to the Instagram account on the Blueprint page in the Radio National website. You'll discover it all there. And this is, yes, Blueprint, Radio National.